We're going to try some questions now, and a few that have come in during the presentations, if I can focus on them first. One specifically for Tim, given your comments regarding benchmarking. Andre Ferreira has asked whether Tim has considered using IPD Ecoledger benchmarks for existing buildings. Tim.
Yeah, hi, this is Tim. Yeah, sorry, no, we have looked at the IPD Ecoledger. We know them very well. I think it's fair to say it's fairly early days in terms of the IPD sustainability product. So, again, we really decided to create, if you like, our own set of KPIs, which we are obviously very comfortable with. And frankly, they're hard data around kilowatt hours, electricity, gas, cubic meters, water, carbon per person, total tons. You know, this is not rocket science, scientry. It's basically hard facts, hard data. And our view, as I said during the presentation, is a lot of the labels go slightly off-piste, and we are focused really on the hard data that go to hard operating costs.
Thanks, Tim. I have another question. This one is aimed at Etienne from Keith Bogdan. He's asking what successes there have been in France with respect to green lease clauses. Are tenants and lawyers taking a particular positive or negative view of such clauses? Etienne.
So yeah, a very fair question indeed. As you may know, France is a Roman law country, which means a lot of things are written, and it's not upon agreed statement that you decide who is right or not. It's also within the legal framework. So you need to bear in mind always that when you write any green clause, you have anyway the general law applying. So the approach with green clauses in lease contracts is a rather prudent one, I would say. At least we recommend to have that. And I would subscribe actually to the approach described by Tim earlier, where we prefer to have a memorandum of understanding with the tenant, where we agree with a kind of minimum level of obligation, where we agree to share information and give access to both parties to measurings and so on, and monitoring information to exchange about concrete and objective data. But adding really green clauses in lease contracts, especially at this stage where the general framework is not really defined, can be dangerous, meaning that you can add a clause which will eventually be a dangerous clause for the execution, for the proper and normal execution of the lease contract. So adding that kind of risk at this stage is a bit risky, we would say. So the approach is really about incentivizing and agreeing on the understanding and the targets we have in common with the tenant, rather than trying to impose any green obligation at this stage. I mean, again, at this stage, given the legal framework, which is currently under definition with the Grenelle, is not fully defined.
Thank you, Etienne. So Laurie, if you can perhaps comment on the green lease aspect first.
Sure. We have several of our investment managers that have really worked, particularly in the office space property types, on the green lease strategy. Not so much in multifamily or industrial or retail. I think the green lease is much better known and understood in office, and it's beginning to be adapted in, particularly in the large central business district office building environment. I don't think it's 100%, but our investment managers, one of them, Hines, here in this country, has been really instrumental in pushing that green office lease forward.
Great. Okay. I have a question from Pat Dowley, specifically to you, Laurie, and that is asking what demand there's been from tenants for more sustainable buildings. And the age-old question, have they been prepared to pay a premium over standard rent?
Yeah, good question. There is demand in the office sector, which is clear, and that I think pretty well understood for green buildings. We are not seeing that demand clearly in other property types. It is beginning to grow in industrial, and retail is spotty. Some retailers want green to be a part of their retail strategy. Oftentimes they do that in-house, but it is in this country, the only place where we see it very clearly is in the office sector, and we don't see a premium. What we see is a discount to value in the office sector where there is not a clear certification of environmental quality and standards. So I think what's happening is it's become so well absorbed or becoming well absorbed that it's not a premium. It's a discount if it doesn't exist.
Okay. I've got a question here from Deeksha Vass. Do you see the legal framework being a big reason for a change in attitude in consumers? And how inclined part of the consumer segment is open to making initial capital investments to save in the longer term? Perhaps if I go to you first, Etienne.
I would say it depends on the culture of each country. I'd say that if the French case is considered, I do think the legal framework has a deep influence over the behavior. While other markets will be kind of possibly more inclined to try and measure the benefits before making the decision. But all in all, I think whatever the legal framework, as an industry, if we are able to actually demonstrate the benefits, and I think quantifying is really key, as I think my colleagues panelists stated as well. If measuring is properly done and the benefit can be highlighted in a friendly way, I would say, and I must say I subscribe fully to the approach where you have a direct measurement like a screen on the floor of your office premises, for instance, where you instantly see that by behaving better, for instance, you are making not only energy savings but in the end cost savings as well. I think that can be very powerful. So what I see in Europe is actually a combination with timing in the markets, combining well with the demand from the end users and investors, combining well again with the fact that the European directive, which was published in 2002, is now getting more and more reflecting in the local laws.
Laurie, perhaps you can comment on that in terms of the
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. The legal framework is interesting in the United States. At the federal level, other than the Green Building Council, which created the LEED certification, there's not a lot of law that drives behavior. There is, in fact, a lot that drives behavior at the local level. Most of our major cities and counties have adopted requirements that are quite high for energy standards and buildings. And I don't know that drives consumer behavior as much as it simply creates an environment in which consumers are located already. So Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Seattle, a whole long list of cities have very stringent green building requirements now in place.
Thanks, Thanks, Larry. Great. Go on, Tim. Yes, please.
Yeah, I was going to add on the UK, we're about to have the what's called the Carbon Reduction Commitment Energy Efficiency Scheme, which is a long word for a carbon tax. Effectively, and it hasn't come into law yet, but it's about to, if you consume over 6,000 megawatt hours per annum across your entire real estate portfolio, whether you're an occupier or a large investor, then there will be league tables published, and based on your consumption, you have to pay tax. So this is becoming a major driver that is forcing occupiers and landlords and investors to really invest in energy efficiency to mitigate this taxation liability. So this is a big factor, and consumers in our language are occupiers, and the occupiers are certainly ahead of the property investment industry, and they are really focused on this. So it's a very key strategic factor.
Thank you. Okay, we have about 5 minutes to go, so I want to try and get just two more questions in. With that in mind, I have a question from Kay Rosido, this is about, we've heard a lot about institutional practice, so when can we expect product offers for private investors? Good question. Etienne, if I can start with you.
Yeah. Okay. I think it's an interesting question because I would say also that within this area size matters, and it's often perceived, at least, as difficult to be focused on improvements if a building is smaller than say 10,000 square meters, for instance. So private wealth size of assets is obviously smaller. What we actually think is there are ways to provide access at least to investments which are comprehending and taking into account sustainability in investment policies. So that's possibly investments which can be targeting in the end private individuals. But also I think that the more experience we will get on improving buildings, improving behavior on a larger scale project, the more likely we will spread the interest. And in the end, I think we've also beginning to see a few experiences with, for instance, smaller retailers, which have a very immediate looking at the benefits of improving the premises, improving the lighting, the heating consumptions, and so on. And in the end, I think it's more of a question of education. But I would say, of course, in this area, the institutions have to kind of take the lead and publish and inform as much as possible. So that's possibly a good F for all of us in the ESG, which is also education.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Evidence and education. Thanks, Etienne. Tim, a quick comment from you on that, perhaps?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with Etienne. I'd also just really stress that initially the legislation and the behavioural activities and the carbon tax are going to apply to big institutional occupiers and investors. But it is filtering down. For example, we have a building in London which is multi-tenanted. It has small office floors, 5,000 square feet. And again, we're engaging with those tenants in the same way we engage with a large government occupier. Really, there should be no difference. We all have the same challenge to meet, and the principles are the same. So I think it'll filter down across the industry. It'll take a few years, but it will get there.
So it's that typical long-tail graph, I suppose.
Indeed, indeed.
Laurie, a comment from you on this, perhaps? Anything further to add on that?
Well, CalPERS is a large institutional investor. The investment managers that work with us and place CalPERS capital into the marketplace are all private investors with varying sizes. And they are, what we, one of the observations is the smaller the investor, the more difficult it is to have a robust environmental strategy. They operate very leanly as investors, and if they have a requirement to to have a robust environmental or ESG strategy, they see that they would need to hire a new person or people. They'd have to have, they'd incur costs to do this. So we get some resistance from our smaller, what I would characterize as boutique investors. Our larger investors, they already have robust platforms. And if I go to them and ask them, you know, what are you guys doing about a certain ESG issue, you know, they'll typically have a staff of people that I can go to talk about that. So size, somebody said size matters, and it really, really does matter in from where we sit with our investment managers that place our capital into the marketplace.
Sure. Thank you. I've got a question here then. In terms of RPI, is there a dichotomy between rationale and results? So really I'm suggesting here that RPI strategy will reflect better performance in time, so there's this leap of faith issue, and is it more or less creditable than the tangible evidence that many seem to require? If I start with Etienne again, please.
Yeah, what I think I see in this area is we have the strong belief that in the longer term it will pay and we will create track records and we will see the results. In Europe at least, I think can tell stories about examples we have and good case studies and that works. The initial benefit I see, the approach is actually it is providing a new, brand new grid of analysis and review of what we actually do in general. And from that point of view only, we're hopefully making more thought decision and more rational decision in general, because we are paying more attention to details we were not caring to take care of before. So I think just from that point of view, we see benefits. And I think Tim made a comment earlier, actually, on the mere fact that if you buy any asset and you do a complementary due diligence, and then after the takedown phase, you take care of checking actually the way it functions, just by doing that, very often you actually save money. So it's a lot about case studies in Europe. We don't have this statistical evidence and co found in the US with Energy Star and LEED rated buildings. But we are building it, and we are seeing good examples of how it works and how the cash benefits are there as well.
Sure, thank you. Tim, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, the other thing I'd add is from a fund management fundraising perspective, we raised our fund in 2008. And at that point, there were numerous global institutions signed up to the PRI. But if you actually go and see them and try to seek capital, it was a very different story. Putting the pounds, dollars, whatever, into action, investment in the greener space, if you like, in real estate, was not easy. So probably, as Etienne says, you know, those in global investors need more examples, more proper benchmarks, etc., and research, which I can, you know, we completely understand. But the take-up of capital into greener real estate has not been what frankly should have been. But you know, hopefully now the market is more advanced. We're now three years on since we first started our fund. We're the first in the UK to do this. But so far, rationale to performance was frankly a bit limited, but I think it's improving, and it'll only improve with evidence.
Sure. Thank you. Laurie, comment from you on that?
Yeah, we see a growing body of evidence, both academic and real estate industry research, that responsible investment practices can enhance value or perhaps more importantly mitigate risk. The Mercer study that I mentioned at the beginning of my comments reports They reviewed various reports that showed positive links between ESG factors and performance. Importantly, in all of the work that they reviewed, they found that there was no harm to financial performance of this type of investment strategy. And I would add that while there's evidence that points to possible premiums at the asset level, we are still looking for that proof or data at the portfolio level, which is really what the UN Property Working Group is all about. Our current initiative is to really look at portfolio metrics, which would be so very helpful, certainly in what we're doing. And that has thus far proved a bit elusive and underscores the importance of further research.
Sure. Great. Okay, thank you for that. Ali, I think we'll leave the specific questions there. I know there's one or two questioners asking about whether they can hear presentations again, so perhaps if you can just cover that whilst we sign off. And before I hand over to you, I'd just like to express my thanks again to the panellists for their time and commitment towards this webinar.